This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
By the way, on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant, and that Super Bowl went just about as well as Seattle could have hoped for. We had a backbreaking gut punch of a defeat for the San Francisco 49ers. Losing a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter is about as tough a way to lose a Super Bowl as possible. It's way worse to have that happen than to get blown out. Like, there's not even a debate in my mind. Like, what's the worst way to lose that game? Oh, it's to feel that you're in really good position and then watch that turn to ash right in your hands.
Yeah, and that's what happened. I mean, I don't know that they ever should have felt that they were about to win the football game, because, I mean, this is a team that they were playing that is led by Patrick Mahomes, and we've seen what he's done so many times over the course of his young career already. But when he threw that interception at the 49ers 13-yard line with about 11 minutes left to go, it was starting to feel like San Francisco, they had won.
My wife she's actually in the Bay Area right now, and she was watching the game at a friend of hers' house about an hour away from San Francisco. After that interception, she texted me, asked, should I leave? Is the game over? And I was like, no, definitely not. And I wondered if Kansas City didn't score on that ensuing possession after the 49ers picked that off. If the Kansas City Chiefs didn't, when they got the ball back, didn't score, would I say it's over? And I was like, no, I don't think so. Not with this team. And it turned out, I mean, there was more than enough time for Kansas City. But, okay, so that's the first part of it that made it satisfying. The second part is that the biggest question hanging over your division rival, the team that won the division this year, is whether their quarterback's truly great. Is Jimmy Garoppolo in that Pro Bowl tier of quarterbacks where you feel that every year this guy's going to give us a shot, we should be in the playoffs every year that this guy's healthy? And you wondered if this was going to be a step in that direction. And if anything, this game and the way Jimmy Garoppolo finished it underscored any concerns. The San Francisco 49ers have to now wonder if they've got a Jared Goff-like player on their hand.
A guy that's
good enough to get you and pilot a team in the playoffs, but when it comes down to crunch time, it's like, okay, we're now in a dogfight. We need somebody to make a play, and that usually needs to be your quarterback. If your quarterback's going to be your highest-paid player, it has to be your quarterback. And he's had multiple opportunities going 3-for-11 in the fourth quarter in his passing at 36 yards and having two times in which they needed a first down. He didn't get the ball out of his hands. That's absolutely brutal.
Goff is such a good comparison, because remember that duck pass that he threw for an interception towards the end of Super Bowl 53 against the Patriots? That was what Jimmy Garoppolo did on his first interception of the game to Bashaud Breeland. And that was, for the most part, what Jimmy Garoppolo did down the stretch. And it is okay for San Francisco. At the very least, they have some, I think, confidence in the fact that he is a competent quarterback given what he did in the middle of the game. But for whatever reason, they put the ball in his hands at the end of this one, and they didn't need to. And I think that's something that they're going to have to look back at and wonder, why did we pass the ball with three timeouts left 12 times down the stretch and only run it four times with
it's
a lead? And with plenty of time on that second to last drive before Kansas City scored the game clinching touchdown by Damian Williams, they had plenty of time to keep on doing what they've been doing all game.
I went and looked up when you brought up that point, because especially they had three drives in the fourth quarter, if you take away the final one where they had just two plays, like three honest possessions where, hey, you're either playing to protect the lead or you're trying to regain the lead. And the first two of those drives, they gained a total of one first down. And in those drives where they're holding the lead, you would expect them to try and milk the clock. And what the division was, three run plays versus five pass plays that came out of those. And it's interesting to look back and say, could they have run it more? Because they certainly could have. They went 1st and 10. They handed the ball off. They get 6 yards. 2nd and 4. They passed, gained a first down. 1st and 10 the next progression of downs. They run it for 1 yard. So they're facing 2nd and 9. They throw it there. And then they get a false start, so they're 3rd and 14, and that's where you have the Jimmy Garoppolo scramble, and he ends up getting hit as he's going out of bounds. They end up punting it back there. The next one, 1st and 10, they run for 5 yards, and then two straight incompletions, and they end up punting. That's probably the one where you end up looking back, and maybe you could second guess it. At the same time, I didn't feel like they were asking or got panicky. They their quarterback just wasn't capable of making plays at that point.
I understand that, and far be it from me to question what a play caller like Kyle Shanahan is calling at the end of a game, but they averaged 6.4 yards per rush in this game. And on that second to last drive where they're up 20-17, where they ran it and they passed the last two downs of that drive, they got 5 yards on first down.
Mm-hmm.
On the last drive that they had a shot of actually winning, they ran the ball once. I understand there's only a couple of minutes left, but you had all three of your timeouts. The first carry that Raheem Mostert gets is for 17 yards.
Yep.
This is one of those games where you have to wonder about the idea that if the 49ers found themselves in a situation like this, shouldn't they have been adequately prepared to still run the exact same game plan that they do for the most part, but just maybe at a more quick pace where they still have the ability to run the football? They had a lot of timeouts left. They had all of them left. They had enough time left, I think, to score on a game-winning drive and still be balanced offensively, which is what they've been doing all season long. And I think they would have been able to get yards against the Kansas City defense. That's a weird spot to play defense. What do you do? Do you make sure that you're staying back to prevent the big play, or do you come up to stop the run in the last 2 minutes? You don't want to do that. So I feel like Kyle Shanahan got away from doing what has made this team as successful as they were all year long. And that, just as much as Jimmy Garoppolo not being able to execute, did them in.
17-yard run by Mostert. They then passed on six consecutive plays. The first two resulted in a first down, but then it was three straight incompletions followed by that fourth down sack, which in many ways, this is what sealed the game here. Fourth and 10, you have the opportunity, and they don't even end up getting a pass off.
And his team up by 10, third down and 14. Garoppolo is going to be forced out and then shoved out of bounds. No penalty flag as Rashad Felton made the play, and it's fourth down.
That's not the play. Here it is.
Five-man rush, shotgun snap, drops back, sets in the pocket, hit, grab, sacked, tried to throw it away. It's deflected, incomplete. Frank Clark. Penalty flag thrown. Pandemonium inside the stadium.
Harlan's the best.
That was awesome. It just reeked of desperation. The ball gets flicked out by some sort of, like, it was a two-handed chest pass. That was what he did, or a volleyball set that he flung out there. Actually, I wouldn't want to insult volleyball players by calling that a set, what he did. That was just fantastic.
I wanted to hear Harlan do what he did. Remember that call that he had? The man is drunk! I kind of wanted to hear him say that about Garoppolo as he just pushed that ball away.
Garoppolo's the person who's going to face the most questions. Kyle Shanahan, I like Shanahan's game plan. I love what they've been able to do, getting receivers that are able. Deebo Samuel's an awesome.
So good.
He's almost a running back, the way that he plays, and they're starting to use him that way. I think they do a lot of really creative things. I do feel that that game conformed to kind of what I've thought about Garoppolo, which is he won't put you in the ditch, but he's not going to be the guy that gets you over the finish line either. Like he's not going to be the reason that you lose it. But if you're counting on him to win the game, that's maybe not the best scenario for your team. I just don't know if he's that kind of quarterback. He certainly hasn't been yet. Maybe he still takes that step. And from Seattle's perspective, that's the best thing that you could have happen.
The guy is drunk.
that was a team that won the division, was railroaded, steamrolled through the playoffs. And now you come back and they're like, they have some actual significant questions to answer this offseason at the most important position.
They can't answer that question unless the question's already answered. That's where they're at quarterback right now. This is not changing. Oh, Jimmy Garoppolo's all of a sudden, he's going to not get wobbleopoly down the stretch. I mean,
that
we know what he is now.
What you just said about that, they can't make a change, because you're absolutely right. They can't make a change. First of all, they don't have a guy that they think is better, which you can't abandon a guy you've paid to be a franchise quarterback until you think you've got somebody that might step in there. The second part is that you're at a spot as a franchise where you're like, well, we've got a defense that's about to get really expensive. Eric mm-hmm. Armstead is the first one of these guys. DeForest Buckner and Eric Armstead, eventually Nick Bosa, all of these players that you have, they're eventually going to get very expensive. And the other thing is, I think you saw pretty clearly that you need speed in the secondary. Their secondary needs to be faster. And that was shown, whether it was Richard Sherman getting picked on and that play to Sammy Watkins, because for years, look, there's no secret about how to attack Seattle's defense when they go in and play the single high safety or the cover three look, as Dave Wyman likes to call and criticize anyone who uses single high safety. Is the corner can't get beat on the outside. He's got to be able to bump and run, and he can't get beat on the outside the numbers. That's just the guideline of that defense. Yeah. And for years, Richard Sherman has been not only fantastic about that, but when you try to do that, he takes the ball away. That's why guys stay away from him.
Right.
He is able to, whether it's baiting or just his ability to make plays in the air, he wasn't even close to Watkins. He was playing catch up from the moment that Watkins got by him, and there was no shot on that play. In my mind, that was the moment where I was like, okay, Kansas City's going to win this game. It put him on the doorstep.
It is not easy to add speed to a secondary, and the Seattle Seahawks know this very well. If you're going to do it, you have to do it either in the draft, and guess what? When you're drafting towards the back of the first round, the chances of you landing that corner that can make a difference become lower and lower. And in free agency, if you find a cornerback that's actually good that hits the market, you're going to have to pay him stupid money like Stephon Gilmore got from the New England Patriots, ultimately seeing him become Defensive Player of the Year over the weekend. That's something that also doesn't just fall into your lap either. And, you know, you continue to add up all the other contracts, Danny. Another one, Fred Warner, who is, I think, one of the better linebackers in the game. That guy, in 2 years, he's an unrestricted free agent. He's only making $800,000 a season right now. So, man, they got so many questions to answer. Speed in the secondary is a hard one to fix overnight. And you know what? It's good for the Seattle Seahawks that is an issue that the 49ers are probably not going to be able to fix in one offseason, because with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, those are two guys that are going to test their limits every single time they go up against them.
How does the Chiefs winning the Super Bowl affect how you feel about the Seahawks? It's a weird question, because you're not really competing against the Chiefs, so to speak. They're not in your division. They're not even in your conference. But they're a team that's laid out pretty significantly differently. They put a huge emphasis on speed. Not that there's any team that doesn't want speed, but they've got an assembled, what they call it, the Legion of Zoom, which is a knockoff nickname or whatever. They've got a quarterback who is, look, Patrick Mahomes is probably at this point, he's the one guy that I could see teams saying they would take ahead of Russell Wilson and feel that that's a pretty compelling reason. Mahomes is a really special quarterback. Lamar Jackson had a great season. Patrick Mahomes has now done it for a couple of years. Like, what Mahomes has done, he is a transcendent player in the league, in the same way that I think Russell Wilson is. They've got an offense that functions much differently than Seattle's offense. To me, that's the first question about Kansas City's Super Bowl run, is do you look at it and say, what are the lessons you can learn from their offense and the way it relies upon its franchise quarterback?
Well, I mean, you could feel good about the idea that you don't need to have all the answers on defense, that you don't need to have all the answers maybe at running back, though. I think the Seahawks actually do have answers at running back with the two guys that they have. But I think that is something that you can definitely feel a little bit easier about. Danny, for me, coming out of this game with Kansas City having won, I definitely am a little relieved from this standpoint. It does not feel like this was a blown opportunity for the Seahawks this year, because I just don't think that their defense would have been able to do anything close to what San Francisco did against the Chiefs yesterday. Because to San Francisco's credit, I mean, for 3.5 quarters, they did a really good job. They really did. Now, ultimately, they did lose. But if the Seahawks are going up against that Kansas City offense, I think that might have been a blowout. And if the 49ers had won that Super Bowl, I would not be able to help but think about the delay of game situation on fourth and short, the fourth and short coming up short with Jacob Hollister at the end of that regular season finale. And now I don't have to feel like they were that close to being NFC West champions and vicariously potentially a team that would be playing the San Francisco 49ers in the NFC championship game.
It is Danny and Gallant. It's time for us now to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
Jess.
Super Bowl edition. Let's
Sweet.
Go. Over the weekend, our very own Walter Jones, former Seahawk left tackle, was honored as one of the NFL's top 100.
It was really cool to see Walter there with his red jacket. It was pretty fantastic. Largent also. That was cool.
Tell me a little bit about Walter Jones, because I know we talked about Steve Hutchinson a little bit earlier. This is a guy who, along with Walter Jones, helped make Sean Alexander as highly paid as Sean Alexander eventually was.
Walter Jones was the single most dominant player that I've seen in an NFL game.
Wow. And he played offensive line, too.
In that 2005 season, what he was able to do to guys. And Ray Rhodes, the former, well, he's been a head coach of the Green Bay Packers, the Philadelphia Eagles. He was the defensive coordinator. And Ray was extremely profane. His description of Walter Jones was this. Walter Jones is the kind of guy that'll pick you up, put you in a paper bag, carry you to wherever he wants to go, put the paper bag down, pick you up out of it, whoop your butt, put you back in the paper bag, and carry you wherever you want to go. Because I've watched film with guys, and I'll sit there and look at it. Look, I know you're embarrassed. I'm embarrassed for you. We can go out and do it again this Sunday, and the exact same thing will happen. Walter Jones, his balance as an athlete and his just athleticism at his size, he's unbelievable.
So basically, don't let him get eggs at the grocery store.
Look, he was, he went years without allowing a sack. And the one time that they did, he gave up a sack because the Washington defense drew up a play in which LeVar Arrington, when Arrington was just a world beater, came in from the side and basically torpedoed Walter Jones, like ear-holed Walter Jones from the side to allow Bruce Smith to come inside, where they called an entire defense that was around knocking Walter Jones over to allow Smith to get it. And that was just how good he was. And he didn't give up another sack for like 3 years after that.
Yeah, well, that's impressive. I wish I had gotten to see some of that. I'm definitely going to have to go watch some NFL films this offseason of those old Seattle Seahawks and that running game with Sean Alexander, who had all of those touchdowns. And I think we know why he got a lot of those touchdowns.
Also noted, he's an extremely nice person.
Huzzah!
Despite his ability on the field and what he would do to people. He's really active in the community. He lives here in Seattle. You see him at all these different events and everything. He's been so kind. I only got to watch him play his final season when I moved out here, but he's a really good guy. Well, the rest of the awards are out. Lamar Jackson winning the MVP.
Not a surprise. We're getting a lot of unanimous MVPs, though. A lot of unanimous MVPs.
Was he so good that he deserved unanimous MVP? Because I thought he had a great season. I thought he should have been the MVP. Yes, over Russell Wilson. But I'm surprised that Russ didn't get a vote. I'm surprised that other players didn't get a vote. I don't feel that the year was so transcendent. It's something that we'll never see again, I guess. And I suppose I want to know what goes into these NFL MVP voters' decisions when they come to a unanimous MVP award.
Well, the first thing to know is that it's just a winner. I think it'd be better if they had a first, second, and third place on the ballot.
That would help,
like they
yes.
do in baseball. The second part is unanimous. I think it was pretty clear. There's only 50 voters. So I think that makes it in some ways easier to come to a consensus. And there's also, and I think some of this comes from the scrutiny that's gone over award decisions, is that guys are afraid to stick out in some cases. Like all of the heat that people take in some of the baseball balloting, or whether it's Hall of Fame, or whether just this past weekend over NFL Hall of Fame, I think there's a bit of conformity that's created because people don't want to be the target of anger over making a decision that's different from other people.
That's understandable, and he was awesome this year. I could totally understand, though, why some one or two people might have voted for him. I mean, he only got one vote for Offensive Player of the Year as well. Honestly, I mean, with the season that Patrick Mahomes had with the dislocated kneecap and statistically not being as dominant as he'd been the year before, like you would think that there would have been some room for Russell Wilson to get a little bit more love. Alas.
Does that make any sense that he's the MVP but not the Offensive Player of the Year? It makes no sense to me.
No, but I think that
it doesn't. And I get why it is, because you want to recognize more than just the guy that wins the MVP.
More than just quarterbacks specifically.
It doesn't make sense to me. Why it would go that way.
Michael Thomas, Offensive Player of the Year, by the way, for those who didn't know.
Stephon Gilmore was the Defensive Player of the Year as well. Unknown to many, Vernon Davis was not retired. He is now. He's officially hanging up the cleats.
Someone whose career forever changed one intersection in time, one moment in time with Cam Chancellor. Afterwards, before that, he was a former top 10 pick who was one of the big game breakers in the NFL, and he still was an effective player, but he also was into pottery.
Pottery. Is that
ceramics?
Is that what Cam Chancellor sent him into?
Yes. He made him, as Dave Weinman would say, rendered him an artiste.
His version of, as Mike Tyson would describe it, Bolivian, is trying to find his way out via arts and crafts.
I could watch that hit 25 times and be no less impressed the 25th time than I was the first. It's incredible.
How do you hit a man that big, that hard, with that much conviction and no hesitation? And
legally.
Right.
Yep. Flags came in from three different directions. Like, everybody threw them in, like, where it's just like, that was so vicious looking, it can't have been legal. Did not get fined.
That play made my dad as angry as I've ever seen him watching football from a couch. I was home for Christmas and we watched the game together, and he lost his mind. 31! What's his name? He's now my favorite player in the league! He went nuts.
Cam Chancellor wrecked dudes. He was a bad man. He folded up offensive linemen.
Well, we all know what Tom Brady's cryptic tweet means now. It means he got a big paycheck because it was just a teaser for a Hulu ad.
If you're Brady, are you a little embarrassed, or do you think this is just cheeky and fun?
I mean, I feel that deep down inside, Tom Brady might secretly enjoy that he sort of stole the spotlight away from Jimmy Garoppolo, the guy who was supposed to replace him in New England, and who is also now playing for the team that he grew up rooting for with this commercial. I mean, Tom Brady's performance in that commercial, better than Jimmy Garoppolo's performance in the Super Bowl.
Is there anything that Brady can do that will sour Patriot fans? If he ends up signing somewhere else, are there going to be people that are mad at him?
He should be able to do whatever he wants with what he did there. I mean, he turned them from a laughingstock franchise into the class of the NFL.
But Boston hates Roger.
It's different, though, because what did Roger Clemens do? He never won a World Series.
That's true.
And Brady won 6 and went to 9. I mean, shoot. I mean, did Clemens get the Red Sox to a World Series after 1986?
They got him there in 86, and that was a franchise. It's not like winning the World Series had been a benchmark for being a beloved Red Sox before that.
That is a city that has had some beloved athletes, Larry Bird, Bobby Orr, and he has lapped all of them by a significant margin. If anyone is upset about him going elsewhere afterwards, I mean, they're never going to be happy as sports fans again.
Is he kind of messing with their emotions? Here it is, me overlooking Gillette Stadium.
Guess what?
Oh, it's a tease. It's a tease for a Hulu commercial.
Gronk did it last year, and I think with Gronk, it's a little bit more fair to be annoyed by it because he had been waffling whether he's going to play or not. But this is the first time that Brady's ever hitting free agency, theoretically, and I thought it was a funny ad. Like, I laughed when he said, the script is telling me that Hulu has the best live sports. I was like, that's funny.
As a deep-rooted Brady hater, I will admit it. It's all born out of jealousy. He's funny. He's a good troll. He does bit parts in TV shows, and he's good at it.
Yeah.
It's really annoying.
Yeah.
But I can say it, and I think that I can speak with authority on the subject, having watched him destroy my team year after year. Anyway, that's it.
That's going to do it.
That's
for
my
us.
TED Talk.
Around the NFL. It is Danny and Gallant. We'll get into a couple other lessons that we learned, and specifically some questions about the 49ers going forward. That's ahead on Danny and Gallant.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant. Is Patrick Mahomes better than Russell Wilson? Kind of the question, and I don't want to answer it because I kind of do think that Mahomes is playing at a higher level right now than Russell has been, but I kind of want to say that, well, they're the two names in a two-man conversation about who the best quarterback in the league is. Mahomes is pretty special, though.
What do you think separates the two? If you had to, what's the first thing that jumps out to you that separates Patrick Mahomes from Russell Wilson?
The speed with which he makes throws. Russell makes huge plays downfield. It seems like it takes him longer to get to those throws, though, whereas whether it's Mahomes and the fact that he throws sidearm or just has weird angles, somehow it seems easier for him. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I haven't worked all the way through it, because it's not that Russell doesn't have a good arm. Russell has an incredible arm. And Russell's deep ball, I think it's the best deep ball in the NFL. Mahomes slings things from odd angles at places that you just don't see it, where you're like, what in the world? There's a flair to the way he plays and scrambles that Russell doesn't have.
There is something to Mahomes' throwing power and accuracy in terms of overall talent. He has, I think, the best arm in the game. And that is not anything to disrespect Russell Wilson with. It is just a fact. I mean, he has taken what Aaron Rodgers can do with Aaron Rodgers' ability to throw on the run and pinpoint the ball and throw it pretty well downfield. I think that he has taken it to another level. So that's number one for me. And number two, even though Russell Wilson, I think, is still a better scrambler than Patrick Mahomes and more dangerous when he takes off and runs the football, I think that Patrick Mahomes is particularly difficult to sack. I don't know why he is that way, but with Russell Wilson, he takes a lot of sacks. There's a lot of similarity to the two's game, because Mahomes has, over the course of the last year, really turned very Russell Wilson similar in that he is very careful with the decisions that he makes. He did not throw a lot of interceptions this season. He will be able to scramble to the outside and get a 2-yard gain or a 3-yard gain, as opposed to taking the sack or as opposed to throwing it away. It's really hard to get a negative play against Mahomes, which is why it's so striking that he had 2 interceptions and 2 fumbles in this game. Yet, I think those are the 2 things that separate him. I think that Mahomes has just a better arm than everyone in the game, and I think he's more difficult to sack.
Does he have a better offense for him?
You could argue that, but think about it from this perspective. It's not like Russell Wilson is throwing to nobody. You can say that, yes, Kansas City has the best receiving core in the NFL with Tyreek Hill and Sammy Watkins, with some of the young guys that they have as well, Mecole Hardman.
You throw Kelce in there, who didn't have a big game, but Kelce's one of their receivers as well, essentially.
Yes, Kelce, yes. At tight end, they have the edge. The Seahawks have better running backs, definitively better running backs. And credit to Damian Williams, who has been awesome in these playoffs. But if you were to pick between Chris Carson and Damian Williams, you don't even think you're picking Chris Carson. You pick between Rashad Penny and Damian Williams, I think you're thinking twice. I think you're thinking for a little bit of time before you determine between those two. I think sometimes we underestimate what Russell Wilson has as a supporting cast. It is not that big, I think, of a discrepancy between the two. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people that are in favor of Russell Wilson being better than Patrick Mahomes will do. They'll say, well, what if Russell Wilson was playing for Andy Reid? Well, what if Russell Wilson was playing with those weapons? I suppose you could make that case, and I suppose you can change guys from situation to situation. But I think when it comes down to it, if you're looking for a quarterback, any quarterback in the game that has the skill set of all skill sets, it's this guy. It's Patrick Mahomes. And, I mean, shoot, this is something that James Palmer from the NFL Network has been tweeting about and talking about over the last couple of weeks. Patrick Mahomes supposedly has some of the best pregame and midgame speeches that you will ever get. They are becoming legendary per some of his teammates. I don't know how they sound. It's probably very froggy, and people buy into it despite the frogginess. And he's the best in the game. And I don't think that there's any harm in admitting that he's the best in the game right now. I mean, is it really that much of a diss to Russell Wilson to say something like that?
No, I don't think it is, because there's no doubt about the caliber of quarterback that Russell Wilson is. Like, he's a Super Bowl winning quarterback, and he's someone that is, if anything, Kansas City's success this season speaks to how much a quarterback of that caliber can compensate for, because I don't think Kansas City's defense is that good. I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's much better than average. I come away from this wondering, from the Super Bowl, wondering how much of an effective running attack matters. San Francisco has one of the league's better rushing offenses in the league, and they averaged more than 6 yards a carry, and they lost. And there's 2 reasons that people should think that it's important to run the ball. The first is that that's the best way to move the ball in the red zone. For all of the different questions and uncertainties about how important running the ball actually is, it's really important in the red zone. And the second thing is, that's how you're supposed to be able to preserve a lead. That running the ball, taking time off the clock at the end, and maybe it's because the San Francisco 49ers didn't give themselves a chance to do it, or maybe it's because they they kind of knew that they were going to need to throw to move the ball. I come away from it wondering how important running the ball is, because that is the spot where the Seahawks have the edge over the Chiefs. And the Seahawks just beat the Chiefs a little more than a year ago, yet I came away wondering how important that is.
It's still important, Danny. It's still important. We can't dismiss it just because a guy like Damien Williams or a guy like Raheem Mostert had the playoffs that they had. And I mean, think about the situations that Kansas City had to do something that it doesn't usually do. Considering they have all the weapons that they do, they're not the most aggressive team in the world. And on a couple of fourth and short situations, they decided to go for it. And when they went for it, they ran the football. They were running little speed option concepts. They were running... Remember that play, that like pirouette slide dance that they had, changing formation, and ultimately ended up being a direct snap up the middle of the field to get one of those short conversions? They ran the football. They did run the football. And you know what? At the beginning of this game, they committed to running the football early on. Is that why Patrick Mahomes had the success that he had in the second half? I don't know, but I imagine that Andy Reid had a specific goal with that first 15-play chart that he decided to put together, and why they gave it to Damien Williams as much as they did, handing it off to him and throwing it to him, 16 combined touches and targets in the first half.
If I'm a person that raises my hands and screams and yells and says every time that Seattle gets into the second round of the playoffs, when they don't have that first round bye, the same thing happens. They fall in a big hole. They rally like hell to get back into it, and then they ultimately fall short. Which, well, it's not if. I am that person. Should I be less outraged by it or less angry about it, given that that's pretty much what Kansas City did through most of these playoffs, and they just won a Super Bowl by overcoming a big double-digit deficit in the fourth quarter? Should I look at that and say, hey, the idea that it's not how you start but how you finish is actually the recipe for winning a Super Bowl?
No, because it's basically you're looking at some sort of master student who procrastinates, and you're thinking that you can do the same thing, and you can't. I mean, you want to. You want to
get pretty close.
But think about it.
They're a couple inches away from getting a shot to beat the Packers.
Who is putting the offense together? No offense to Brian Schottenheimer, but we're comparing Andy Reid and Brian Schottenheimer. They are not even close. Andy Reid is one of the best offensive coaching minds in the league's recent history. There's a reason for that. There's a reason over the last 20 years he's been able to do what he has done. And that's what you get when you have a really creative offensive mind. And that's nothing against Schottenheimer necessarily. We're talking about an all-time great in terms of offensive minds. So I think the idea that you can just say, all right, well, eventually Russell Wilson is going to save us, that is not a strategy. That is just an option that the Chiefs have because of how good Patrick Mahomes is. They would not like to do that. I think next year during the playoffs, they're probably going to say to themselves, you know, it was nice that we had all these comebacks. We need to get off to better starts.
How do we reconcile that, though? And I'm sure that we'll get into this in the days to come. And Russell Wilson talked to Pro Football Talk there at the Super Bowl on Friday about kind of the question of the offense. On the one hand, you've got a team with a transcendent quarterback that has built its offense pretty unapologetically around that quarterback and been able to overcome big deficits that they fall into. On the other hand, you have a team that is much more oriented toward a ground game, that also has a habit of falling into big double-digit deficits, that ends up coming back. We look at it and say, well, you know, they're not constructed. They're not built to have the kind of game plan that the Kansas City Chiefs do. I'm having a hard time reconciling those things. I don't want to blow it out of proportion and say, hey, this team's got a huge sort of fork in the road moment, considering how close they were to beating San Francisco in the regular season finale and winning the division, given how close they were to getting the ball back with a chance to win on the road in Green Bay, given how young they are, that they're the fourth youngest team in the league. At the same time, I look at the reason at what Kansas City did, and I wonder if things are constructed the right way in Seattle. They're not going to have a defense like they did in 2012 to 2014 again. I think it's very unlikely we see that again. So what's their best bet? What's their best way of being able to get to the playoffs? Is it changing some of the things or changing some of the way that they put together their offense to better accentuate their biggest strength?
It could be, but I think it's very clear that the defense is the thing that needs the biggest overhaul. If you're going to copy the Chiefs fired their entire defensive coaching staff last year, and they brought in new pieces as well. Rashad Breeland, as we talked about, Frank Clark they traded for, Tyrann Mathieu they bring in as well. They brought in a lot of pieces, and they had Chris Jones to build around as it was. They have more playmakers right now than the Seahawks do on that defensive side of things, and that's what Seattle needs to find. Because you know what? You can have an average defense, but if that average defense is getting takeaways and plays aggressively, then you have a shot to potentially flip the field and throw a curveball at an offense that you might, for the most part, over the course of a 60-minute game, not be able to stop very often.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about what this conversation was like the Chiefs 12 months ago about their defense, and to consider what maybe that's where the drastic steps need to be. It's Danny and Gallant. We're going to raise flags, throw them, and I'm definitely going to throw one. We'll explain next.
From the pocket and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
It is time for us to take stock of everything that has happened. Assess penalties. Sometimes lift penalties, remove them after consultation, or maybe raise a flag just in general salute. And after the Super Bowl, we'd like to do. Paul, would you like to start?
Yeah, this one has nothing to do with the Super Bowl, but Antonio Brown getting yet another chance to, quote, apologize, end quote, and try to rehabilitate his image. I'm tired of this. Did ESPN really need to give him this platform to say things that were completely hollow? For him to apologize and be really sorry and contrite for everything that's happened, but at the same time say, the kind of guy who has the bad narrative about him, I was pleased to hear positive things about me after 140 days. The guy, while apologizing, that's saying, the media will run with it, so even if I'm not guilty, I'm already guilty because they already wrote it, put it on TV, and put that in people's minds. He is a guy that feels he has been victimized. He is not someone who is actually sorry. I hated watching that apology video on Saturday.
I hated the interview. I hated his answers. I didn't hate the interview, though. I think it's... Yeah, I was interested in hearing from Antonio Brown. I'm surprised he doesn't have better public relations advisors to tell him that, okay, this wasn't an apology. The other thing is, and maybe this kind of segues into... I watched the Aaron Hernandez documentary on Netflix, which is fascinating for a number of reasons as well. We've gone away from... We've looked for reasons or explanations why someone might do abhorrent criminal things. And Antonio Brown's not accused of murder, but he has had accusations of sexual misconduct.
Multiple.
And kind of this question of, is it a head injury? Is it CTE? Is it in Aaron Hernandez's case? There was a lot of conversation about his sexuality and things that have caused this sort of rage. And I guess I can see that from a sociological perspective, but there's also a level of accountability. When I heard the interview with Antonio Brown, what I heard that was definitely missing was accountability. It's very easy to apologize. And when you can't apologize effectively, usually it means that you don't really understand what you did wrong or you don't think it was wrong.
Exactly. And I thought this was hollow. And in the case of Antonio Brown, in the time we're now, I do think that we sometimes dive too far into things that we see out covered nationally and look for a cause when very often the simplest of answers is the correct one. Personal responsibility. Of which Antonio Brown has shown none for any of his many actions over the last couple of years. You could point at a variety of different reasons for causes, and you could say that the guy needs help. But for me, he is ultimately the one that's responsible for his issues. And yeah, I don't like that it feels like people are making excuses for him while they're doing those things.
Jess, do you have any flags to raise, throw, pick up?
Yes, raise for sure. And that is for the women in the halftime show. I thought that they were wonderful. I don't particularly enjoy halftime shows regularly. And it's a show. Anyone who has an issue with the fact that they were lip syncing, who cares? The people came to watch a game and a show. They didn't come to listen to the lyrical genius that both of the women are anyway. And it's okay. It's not like they were lip syncing somebody else's music. How many hits did each of them have? I knew every single song. And I was out in public. It was blaring through the bar we were all at. And we all, everybody just stared in awe of the halftime show. I thought it was great. I thought it was an awesome performance. So I'm raising my flag for them.
I would say this. Shakira's songs have been going through my head all morning. Catchy? Kind of a little bit of an earworm?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I would also like to point out that it took place in Miami, which is where Prince performed. I believe it was the Colts-Bears Super Bowl, and it was all rainy. And according to legend, when they called Prince to let him know, I think Prince is one of my favorite musicians. They told him that it was raining out there, and his response was, "Can you make it rain harder?" Which is like the most Prince response ever. Oh, I love Prince. Lydia.
I'm going to raise a flag for my good friend Taylor Fresh Jacobs today, who was celebrating yesterday with his family. His dad is from Kansas City, so it was an exciting day in the Jacobs household. And Tay and I have bonded for over many reasons, but the fact that we've both been tortured fans in certain fan bases, myself with the St. Louis Blues, and talk about a 50-year drought. They were able to quash that this year, and now the Kansas City Chiefs, 50 years in the making. So pretty excited for him. He's got to get the Maple Leafs next. That's where his mom's from. So sorry about that one.
He's on a roll. He's living a spoiled life.
Because he's got Toronto. Toronto Raptors.
The Raptors won a title. Now the Chiefs. Good for him. I'm going to throw a flag. It's 15 yards for unnecessary cross-pollination. The Super Bowl advertisement stunk, and here's specifically what I hate. They're not respecting the boundaries of corporate limits. You can't advertise Charmin and Bounty in the same advertisement that you're subjecting me to Febreze. You need to respect brand differentiation, and the fact that Tide was woven throughout, I don't care if it was Charlie and everybody loves him. I don't want to see that in a Wonder Woman ad, and somebody was like, oh, but it's more of a political statement by the college. No! This is how we end up with KFC, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut hybrids, which are an abomination and a pox upon modern America. Like, whenever the fall of Rome and people say, here's when you knew Rome was in trouble. For us, it was when they put Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, two great tastes that should never be merged together in the same spot, and we got hybrid advertising. It was awful.
I mean, I think you kill as many birds with one stone as you possibly can. I mean, let's be honest. The commercial part of the Super Bowl has been vastly overrated for years. It just honestly, it shouldn't be a part that we sit and watch. Oh, let's critically break down these advertisements.
When did that start? When was it the Budweiser frogs? Was it prior to that?
Oh, well, the Budweiser frogs, I mean, were great, as were the What's Up ads. Very original a campaign.
Oh, yeah.
I think the Bud Bowl is the first one that I remember. When they had a planned advertisement over Bud facing Bud Light, you had the freezer when it was a 40 that was the 40 that was brought out of the fridge. Like, that's what I first remember. They had little characters that they developed over. Here's my issue: isn't about like getting it all out of the way or whether it's high art or not. I know that everything in this country is owned by the same five companies. I just don't want to be reminded of it. Can we at least preserve the illusion that there's some bootstrap capitalism going on?
Lie to me, says Danny.
Yeah, instead, I just feel like I'm the old man and So I Married an Axe Murderer talking about the secret triumvirate that includes Colonel Sanders, because you'll buy me chicken because I put a secret ingredient in it that makes you crave it fortnightly.
Hit! Move!
Like an orange on a toothpick.
That's a great movie.
It's a great half of a movie. The end of that
movie. You don't like the end?
No. The back half of it is unwatchable, and I've watched that movie probably 50 times.
Might have to rewatch it now.
The back half is horrible. It played at the Aptos Twin when I worked there one summer. We'd stay late, watch it overnight, leave when the sun came up. That's going to do it for us. I'm a recovering movie usher, and he's Paul Gallant, and, he apparently doesn't have any problems with our corporate overlords.
He's Danny O'Neill, and he has apparently been entirely removed from his group of friends for trolling them during the 49ers choke job yesterday. So long, farewell, until we talk again tomorrow.
It was just so much fun.